Hi, I'm James.
And I'm Anthony.
And this is Words and Numbers. Anthony will disappoint us even more than usual when I say, what's new and exciting in your world this weekend?
Somebody sent me a tweet from Bernie Sanders about a week or two ago.
Oh, here we go. The foolishness of the week comes later.
Well, Sanders says something that struck me as reasonable.
I would bet anything that we're about to get something that sounds a lot like, well, Bernie sounded like he was right at the surface of things, but an inch below that, and here's what we actually
Yeah, well, actually, that's the way the whole story turns out. The thing that he said...
Funny how you can predict this with Bernie.
The thing that he said, and I'm paraphrasing the whole business, he was looking at social services in Denmark, Canada, Finland, Norway, Sweden, you know, the usual countries that he would point to and say we need to be more like them. He was saying they have free healthcare, free college, all of this stuff. I went and looked up how much after-tax income people have in each of those countries. Because, of course, all this stuff that's quote-unquote free, you actually pay for through taxes. So let's ask a reasonable question. What's the difference in after-tax income, these countries versus the United States? And I expected to find something, but I expected it to kind of average out that, okay, we have more after-tax income, but we have to pay for these various things. These other countries, they get them through the tax system, but it should end up being, roughly speaking, a wash. Well, it turns out it's nothing close to a wash. The United States, the average after-tax income, and when I say after-tax income, this is including all taxes, federal, state, local. It's also net of transfers, so money the government gives to people. So think about money that the government gives to the poor in various forms, maybe housing subsidies or income assistance, these sorts of things. When all the dust settles, you compare the United States to Norway, Sweden, Finland, Denmark, Canada. Of course, the numbers vary a little bit across those countries, but not too much. They're roughly the same. United States, the average after-tax income is more than 50% higher than these other countries. This is also, by the way, adjusted for differences in cost of living. They're coming in around $33,000, $34,000. United States is coming in over $50,000.
This has been the case for a long, long time. And every time you see somebody try to dig into these numbers, they get the exact same result.
Yeah, so I pushed a little bit further here and I said, okay, well, maybe it's still a wash when you consider, all right, we're making the average household here $51,000 after taxes versus whatever it is, the $33,000 or $34,000 after taxes elsewhere. Maybe what happens is we're spending about that difference on healthcare. Well, it turns out that's not the case either. The difference we're talking in after-tax income is roughly $17,000, a bit more than $17,000. I looked up the average out-of-pocket for health insurance in the United States. And when I say out of pocket, I mean the part that you have to pay, the co-payments, the deductibles, whatever it is, plus the premiums you have to pay. Put that all together, and of course it varies by state, but it's round about $5,000 a year. Now, big footnote, this is for employer-provided health insurance, so it's not the private stuff. But it's coming out around $5,000 a year, $5,500 a year versus the $17,000 a year difference in after-tax income.
I think there's an interesting thing to be done here. Compare inflows and outflows of state populations in the United States. We've often said, well, New York, California, they're bleeding people into southern states. But so too a number of countries we could probably look at. And I wonder what the inflows and the outflows at the nation level start to look like. Because my best guess here, and it is only a guess, is that the United States has more inflows than probably any other country, even with our draconian immigration
policy. Yeah, I think ultimately that's the answer to the question. Is what you have on net better or worse? Just look at where the people are going. But here's one more thing. I mentioned these numbers to somebody recently, and this person came back with, well, yeah, but you're forgetting something. And that is that Europeans, although they may be earning less after taxes, they work less. They have more holidays than we have in this country. Maybe they work fewer hours, this sort of thing. So I pulled data on this as well, and this comes from the OECD. Americans work on average, and this is accounting for differences in the average work week. It's also accounting for differences in lengths of vacations, time off, all of this stuff. Americans work about 25% more in terms of hours than Canada, Denmark, Finland, Sweden, Norway. But if you account for the hours worked as well as the after-tax income, we're still earning on a per-hour basis more than 20% more than the people in these other countries, again, after taxes and adjusted for differences in cost of living. And all of this brings to mind Thomas Sowell's argument that healthcare may be expensive when you have to pay for the insurance companies and all of this business, but imagine paying for all of that plus the government on top of it to administer the whole thing. And of course, it's going to be more expensive.
And yet we're going to hear the chorus of boos when people think about this. Do like Ant did and go look at the data. You'd be surprised what you find there. Ant, I want to talk about a breathless headline that I saw today about Chipotle. Chipotle is building robot cooks. And I thought, ooh, I got to look into that. So I did. And of course, it's way short of what the headline would have had me believe. But it was interesting nonetheless. It's that Chipotle has got some robots making tortilla chips. If you can automate that process, well, you're better off. And this is to combat labor shortages. Can't find people who would be willing to stand there making tortilla chips, so they're building machines to do it. When I see this story, I think, well, that's exactly how it's supposed to work. When you're trying to hire people to do a job and they won't take the job, you have to explore other avenues. And if you can get a machine to do this, well, then you could repurpose your human employees to other better things.
Right.
I'll give you exactly one guess as to which state this is playing out in. Go ahead, guess.
I was going to say it can't be California.
No, it has to be California.
Oh, because of the high labor costs. Sure, sure.
That's right. Nobody in California is willing to make chips all the day long. Enter the new technology. And they're doing it in one location in Irvine, which is a particularly well-heeled community. But they're going to deploy others before long. I just think it's interesting that people are unwilling to do certain jobs. And hey, let's be honest, Ant, you and I are unwilling to do any number of jobs, right? And that's just how the labor market is. These sorts of things play out to everybody's benefit.
Necessarily, it would be everybody's benefit if nobody wants those jobs. It's not hurting anybody for them to disappear. And to someone who might say, well, but look, you really are destroying jobs here. Don't forget that there are going to be all sorts of jobs created because those robots need to be built, they need to be installed, they need to be maintained, they need to be programmed, and those are actually far better jobs than the jobs that the robots are replacing.
I anticipate that automation of all kinds of tasks will come along. But notice, it's automation, right? There's no intelligence to the machine.
Right.
It's not like a robot walked in and said, how can I help you? More is the pity, right? I would like a robot that would come to my house and say that. We'll move on to the foolishness of the week. And for once, Ant, I'm just so irritated that we don't have a single event that's the foolishness of the
week. Don't tell me. The first time in 4 years of our podcasting, you have not found something foolish?
Oh, I've got all kinds of foolish things, but they don't reduce to one thing. You've probably heard me complain over the years that human beings, I'm not just saying Americans here, I think human beings writ large, we have this notion that what we need to do is engage in some sort of activity in some sort of performance area after which 3 or 5 or 7 people will hold up signs and tell you how good you were. And you have to deal with this drama about the judges and how they react. And it gets even worse because not only do we do that, we also allow our good friends from Hollywood to give each other awards while we watch. I can't imagine why anybody would sit and watch the Oscars. I have literally not one clue. But imagine my surprise when the day after this self-love festival happened, that another one of the things I think about a lot had come to pass at the Oscars. I always say that the world would be a much nicer place if everybody knew that a punch in the mouth was a possible outcome to the current behavior. And don't you know, Will Smith got himself all in a lather and went and slapped Chris Rock. I happen to like both of these guys. I've got no dog in this hunt. The joke that Chris Rock said just didn't seem to be all that offensive. It's starting to look like Will Smith's a bit of a snowflake. And I guess he's got some kind of long-term issue with his wife that plays out in public from time to time. And then enter the nice people who run the Oscars. They've now banned Will Smith for 10 years. For violence, For God's sake, this is a slap, right? This happens at every Irish pub I've ever been in by about 11 o'clock. and we all know this. But here's the funny thing. Will Smith turned down, apparently, the lead role in Django because it was, quote, too violent.
Yeah, I recall that. Yes.
And this just gets dumber by the second. Here is the irritation or foolishness of the week. Pick whatever word you want. Why on earth do we have to turn everything into a contest?
Well, I'm not one for conspiracy theories. Yet, if you consider that viewership of the Oscars has dropped by, I'm doing the numbers off the top of my head, basically a 90% decline in viewership. Except, I bet viewership is up significantly next year simply because of the slap.
I might have walked down that conspiracy road with you had Will Smith not been banned for 10 years. That's enough proof that this actually happened. This was more or less nothing. Will Smith has bad manners, and Chris Rock has actually a certain kind of grace.
And it's funny you say that about the manners, because that thought occurred to me as people are going back and forth about this is violence on the part of either one of them, if you want to think about words as being violent or whatever it is. Nobody seemed to say anything about it simply being in poor taste, that this was bad manners. People tend not to talk about that anymore. Everything has to be at the extreme. It's violent or it's not. How about simply it's just rude?
And there's a lot of things that I think get swept under the carpet. We ought to hold people accountable in certain personal ways. We shouldn't have to rely on the rule of law for every little offense. Right. People shouldn't take the approach that they're going to do exactly as much as they could get away with. And, you know, just an example from a few days ago. If you're on a plane, keep your shoes on, for God's sake. What's wrong with these people? If you're in the airport, talk on the phone in a quiet corner somewhere. Don't do it right next to a bunch of other people.
And none of this has anything to do with whether you have a right or the other person has a right. It has to do with being polite, being considerate of people around you, period.
These are rude behaviors. Hmm. And occasionally when somebody talks on the phone in high voice right near me, I participate in the conversation too, which makes everybody very uncomfortable. Do you know how in an airport you have to leave that seat between you and the next person as you wait?
Right.
When somebody's loud on the phone, I'll sit in that seat and participate in the call. And that's almost always enough to get that person to leave and go somewhere else. I think it's probably time to reevaluate a number of the things that we do and ask the more obvious question about things. How do these impact other human beings? And should I be doing them?
Right.
And just because you can doesn't mean you should. We seem to have forgotten that. I think you and I are in that last generation that was raised with certain kinds of slaps in our own personal life when we did and said things that we ought not. My mother was only too quick to remind me what good manners looked like. Only her and that damn bar of soap that she kept stuffing in my mouth. I guess we can conclude now that it was only a limited success, but well, I'll take what I can get. Anyway, there will be no link. There will just be irritation. The show notes will doubtlessly include other things that you will find fascinating.
To get more Ant and James, buy a copy of our excellent book, Cooperation and Coercion. You can find the paper and electronic versions on Amazon and the audio version on Audible. If you'd like to support Words and Numbers, make your way over to patreon.com/wordsandnumbers, where you can contribute to our podcast-making habits. If you'd like to schedule us to come speak at your event, be it corporate or educational, or have James officiate at your wedding, send us an email at wordsandnumberspodcast@gmail.com.
Today we're recording from Mount Hebron High School in Ellicott City, Maryland. In front of us are 150 students who comprise the largest and objectively most successful economics program in Maryland, likely in the country, possibly in the world. Under the direction of their teacher, Van Prime, the economics students at Mount Hebron participated in the National Economics Challenge, a competition among 10,000 high schools across the country. Mr. Prime's students have won the national championship 6 times, placed as national finalists 9 times, and won the Maryland State Championship 16 times. Not satisfied with dominating in the United States, the students have also participated in the International Economics Olympiad, where they won first place in the world. If you'd like to learn more about Van Prime's astounding students, look in the show notes for links to their media appearances. The students have submitted to us ahead of time some questions that they're interested in discussing, so we've picked some of the more interesting ones, and I have in front of me a 10-page document of over 120 questions. We're not going to be able to get to all of them, but we picked some of the more interesting ones and also ones that touch on topics that several students have mentioned. And we've asked the students to come up and ask their question. We'll respond, and feel free to stay here if you have any follow-up questions that we can address, and treat this more like a conversation than a presentation.
Like how congressional members don't have incentives to do the right thing because they're going to face the consequences of it. American people are.
We can all decide not to buy anything from Amazon. The fact that we don't leads me to believe that people find value in the corporation. I know I do. When the whole world shut down, Amazon became a very important part of my everyday life because I could order things and get them delivered even though every store in Tucson was shut down. What you're really asking, I think, is does Jeff Bezos make too much money? Does he make so much that there's not enough left over for other people? And that's an argument I hear more and more. I don't think it's the right argument. How much would be too much? I don't know what the answer would be. We often say he should pay his fair share. What is his fair share? I don't get an answer to that either. That's a great political line to put out. These rich people should pay their fair share. But when you have the follow-up question, what's that? Nobody has an answer. And we did some math on this, meaning to say, I asked and Anthony did a bunch of math on this. To figure out what would happen if we wanted to finance our government with all the billionaires' wealth, not their income, but their wealth, everything they own. If we confiscated every billionaire's property 100%, we could fund governmental activities for about 9 months.
And that's assuming we could sell off their assets and get full market value, which isn't going to happen.
Which isn't going to happen. I ask for the answer to the simple question, how much? When I do get an answer, it's a very strange answer because it's less than they already pay in the first place. So people think they don't pay anything. They actually pay quite a lot. When Warren Buffett said, well, my secretary gets taxed at a higher rate than I do, that's nonsense. That's not correct at all. And Warren Buffett knew that. It's demagoguery on every side of this discussion. And I don't see a way through it until we answer the basic question. How much should anybody owe the rest of us? And I think there is a right answer here. And I know it's not zero. The anarchists would say we don't owe anything to each other ever. Of course we do. We owe all kinds of things to each other. But the communist answer, 100%, that's idiotic too. I can tell you that whatever the right answer is, it's not zero and it's not 100. So we're left with an answer in the middle somewhere, and our answer is roughly 18%, which Ant will talk about in a minute, I'm sure. And we can then look at what we would call reasonable countries around the world, the Scandinavian countries, Denmark, Western Europe, and they all have radically different answers than we do. We say 18%. They're up closer to 60 in a couple of cases. The question that I'm asking is a justice question, and there are a number of correct answers, and the correct answers come from the people who live under the regime.
If you look historically at all the money the federal government has collected, from all taxes, fees, tariffs, whatever, total amount of money the federal government collects over time, it's a pretty constant 18% of GDP. It doesn't matter whether we're in a period where we're taxing the rich a real high amount, like once upon a time we taxed the rich at 92%, it doesn't matter if in the Reagan years we're taxing at 28%. It doesn't matter whether we're taxing corporations or consumers. It doesn't matter whether you're taxing real estate or capital gains or income. Regardless of what we do, the federal government collects a pretty constant 18% of GDP. I don't know why it's 18%. All I can tell you is it is. If that's the case, let's just be honest with ourselves and say we have decided in some way, whether it's the voters or the market or what have you, we decide 18% is the right answer.
And it's been the right answer since the 1950s.
Yeah.
This is not a short-term thing. Ant and I started writing about this, and we would call the Congressional Budget Office to task because the CBO overestimates what the receipts are going to be every single year. we started writing about the 18%. And one day we got a phone call from congressional Republicans asking if we would sit on a conference call with all their staff to explain how we did this. So we said, sure. And the first question they asked was, how many economists do you have working for you? At which time we both burst into laughter. And they said, well, how are you guys always right about what the figure is? And we said, we just multiply by 0.18.
They weren't interested in that because that would have unemployed half of them.
Yeah. And the guy who runs the CBO started sending us hate mail, which I thought was fantastic. If there's a guy in the government I want to make angry, he's way at the top of the list. You start to realize that the way the tax code is written, it's designed to be taken advantage of. Everybody knows you're going to have all these deductions, and if you're not a crazy person, you'll take them. I talked earlier about my mortgage deduction. I have a massive mortgage. I write that right off at the end of every year. My three little tax deductions that used to run around the house, right? My children. It's designed to give you a certain answer. And when it gives you the answer of 18% every single year, you have to realize that all of the yammering away of the political class is just smoke and mirrors, because you're going to pay about the same no matter what they say.
I want to pick up on something you said a moment ago, or maybe James said in response to you, about how much is too much. We point to Jeff Bezos. In my day, it was Bill Gates, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Now it's Jeff Bezos. You point to Jeff Bezos and you say, well, but he's worth $100 billion or whatever it is. One of the things that people get wrong is they imagine in their minds that he's somehow collected $100 billion. That's not the case. His stock is worth $100 billion. It's like saying, those of you who own cars, it's a lot different to say I've got a car whose book value is $10,000 than it is to say I've got $10,000 in my pocket. You can be a poor teenager with a $10,000 car. You're still poor. I'm not saying Jeff Bezos is poor. I'm saying he doesn't have $100 billion in his pocket. It's what his stock happens to be worth. But here's the thing. We suffer from an observation bias when we think about rich people like Jeff Bezos, because we see the dollars that he has collected from selling us stuff on Amazon. And we can see that. And we can say, look, he's got all these dollars. And we have this misapprehension about how economics works, that he's collected these dollars and somehow he has dollars and we don't. And that means he's better off and we're not. We're only looking at half of the transaction. You're seeing the dollars he collects. You're not talking about the goods and services we got in exchange. Take Steve Jobs as an example. Steve Jobs died with $8 billion in the bank. And people say he's got all these dollars. What the hell, man? The other half of that transaction is we have smartphones. Now, if you want to say to Jobs, you need to give back half of the money that you've collected. Okay, should we be giving back half of our smartphones? Because that was the other half of the transaction. And notice what's happened. We only see the one part. We don't see the stuff that we get. There's another observation bias here, which is it's very easy to measure the profit that someone like Bezos makes, because we can see how much dollars he brought in. We can subtract from that the dollars it cost him to provide the goods. We can measure precisely how much profit he walked away with from our transactions. What we cannot measure as easily, but which exists nonetheless, is the profit we walk away with. And we don't call it profit. For example, I have these really cool earbuds that I bought for, I don't know what they were, $100. I paid $100 for these things. Now, something we rarely ask is, Davies, what's the maximum you would have been willing to pay for this? Now, these are cool things. I get a lot of use out of them. I'm using it to record right now because, like an idiot, I left my microphone at home. These are useful to me. They've been very good. They're high quality. I would have been willing to pay $300. I'm very happy that I didn't, but if pressed, I would have paid $300.
And that's a really interesting thing, because I live in the desert. My air conditioner died within moments of my buying the house I'm in. I found out that air conditioners cost a lot more money than I ever thought possible. As soon as I got one, the other one died too. It cost me $30,000 to replace these two things at my house. And that's enough to make you terrified if you're a homeowner. However, my wife was complaining about this, and I said, it doesn't matter. There's no amount they could have said that I wouldn't have paid.
Well, there is.
Yeah, but it's so far past market value that they never would have gotten
it. Yeah, but notice the thing. Let's suppose, for the sake of argument, the maximum James would have paid is $100,000 for his air conditioning.
It's hot there. I'd have paid it.
Let me get to the punchline. Suppose the maximum he was willing to pay was $100,000. If it was $101,000, he would have said, no, I'll just live without the air conditioning. $100,000 is the maximum he's willing to pay. He actually paid $30,000. He walked away with a profit, I'll use the term loosely. He walked away with a profit of $70,000. Now, we never measure that. And yet, that is as real as the profit we do measure on the corporate side. When we look at the difference between what we paid and what it cost them to produce, we only see one half of the transaction. We never see this other half. And because we don't see the other half, we walk away with this misguided notion that the corporations and the rich people like Bezos are collecting all this wealth to themselves. But really what's happening is we're only looking at that one side. We aren't looking at this.
And the implication here is that they take the money home and put it all over the place and roll around in it like Scrooge McDuck.
Right.
And that's not right at all. But what is right is more often that scene at the end of It's a Wonderful Life where Jimmy Stewart is explaining to the people, your money's not in the bank. Your money's in his farm.
Right.
And in his store.
His mortgage is from Jeff Bezos, who is the savings, puts it in the bank, and now James could borrow it.
As robots continue to take over much of the unskilled labor, what do you see happening to the future of the labor market? Will there always be a market for unskilled labor, or will people have to be forced to learn a skilled job?
This is a question that humans have been asking since the invention of the wheel. With every new invention, whether in our case it's robots, and before us it was data, and before that it was the Industrial Revolution, and before that it was agricultural improvements, every single time, smart humans have said the exact same thing they're saying now. This is going to unemploy so many people. Chronically, from henceforth, humans will be out of work because of this new thing. And every single time, these smart people have been wrong. Think about at the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, when all of a sudden we had steam engines, a single steam engine could do the work of 10 people. Smart people at the time said, this is the end of labor. We're going to have this permanently unemployed labor class because of these steam engines. Today, we have as low unemployment, perhaps lower, than we had prior to the Industrial Revolution, despite the fact there are 10 times the number of human beings. And we're all living at a higher standard of living. What happens is, as machines take away from us the need to do drudge work, we become able to do the things that humans are uniquely empowered to do, and that's to imagine new things. And as we imagine new things, all of a sudden our work changes. It becomes less and less physical and more mental. There are some of us who still do the physical work and are particularly good at it. Those of us, like James and myself, who aren't particularly good at it, thank God we don't have to. We can now do intellectual things. Look at all of you. There's 150 of you sitting here discussing economic and political topics. 100 years ago, you couldn't afford to do that. You'd all have to be out in the fields growing stuff, because if you didn't, you'd die. That's a standard of living we've achieved because of these things that every smart person throughout human history has said is going to spell the end of labor.
Turns out it is a wonderful life. Turns out.
Yeah.
Ant, I think, glosses over this a little bit. I think we all do. Some people are going to lose here.
Yes.
And they're going to lose big, and it's going to be really painful for them. But I want to point you to a couple of things. Henry Ford has it in his mind that what he can accomplish is making automobiles cheap enough that regular people can afford them. How's he going to do this? He's going to set up a factory on a conveyor belt, and people, their labor will be divided such that we can get a lot done, and it'll work out really well. What's the argument then? What about all the people who take care of horses? What about the people who make saddles, who make riding crops? What about people who sell the manure of horses to other people? And every single argument that you got back at that time was in line with this idea that there's an entire industry, horse keepers, that's going to go belly up. And it absolutely did. You kind of have to understand that that's what's going to happen. In retrospect, with lots of years to look back on it, we can say, yes, that was for the best. And there were other salutary effects that came too. Imagine in New York City, when horses are the only way that things come in and go out. If you know anything about horses, you have to know that New York City is going to be a very smelly place, and people are going to be in ill health because of all the poo that's on all the street.
It was a worse environmental problem than what the cars caused today.
Much, much worse. And people have done some pretty interesting work on this. You can go find it if you like. My son, he doesn't want to go to college. He wants to get into the trades. He came to me one day and he said, how well can I do if I drive a truck? And I said, boy, don't do it. And he said, why not? I said, because there won't be truck drivers in 20 years. There are already self-driving trucks. When you can have 18-wheelers going over the road with no driver, that pushes all of our costs down on literally everything. And that's exactly what's going to happen. On the personal level, we'll probably own cars that we don't have to drive. But nobody's going to run trucks with drivers.
Great for us, horrible for truck drivers.
Truck drivers are going to pay for this. And I think the winning bet is not to have any more truck drivers. Even airplanes, the technology exists right now to land them and to take off without any human involvement.
There's an interesting moral question here that goes along with the economic question. The economic outcome is, look, self-driving trucks are good for all of us because it's going to mean lower priced goods. It's bad for truck drivers because it means they're going to be out of a job. And furthermore, the benefit to the rest of us far exceeds the cost to the truck drivers. So from an economic perspective, absolutely, driverless trucks are the way to go. That's one side of the discussion. The other side of the discussion is not economic, it's moral. What about these truck drivers? They're human beings. What you can do? Just say, well, I'm sorry, you just can't earn a living anymore. There's a transition that we have to think about. Now, in this transition, some of these truck drivers are going to be younger people. And those younger people have decades in front of them. They can retrain for something else. I'm less concerned about them. I'm more concerned about the truck driver who's been a truck driver for 40 years. He's 5 years, 10 years from retirement. He's too old to retrain for something else. What do we do with this guy? One possible answer, I'm not necessarily advocating this, but I'm saying it is reasonable. One possible answer is that we put in place some program. We say, okay, we're going to tax everybody. And with this tax money, we're going to take you, Mr. Elderly Truck Driver, we're going to cut you a check for the money you would have earned had you kept your job. And we're just going to keep cutting you these checks until you reach retirement age, understanding you're no longer a truck driver, you're basically unemployed. That keeps your standard of living where it was. You don't lose out. Now, that achieves a couple of things. One, it achieves the moral outcome of we're not just leaving this guy to be destitute. He's got no other options. Two, it achieves a transition out of truck driving. If we didn't do this, the truck drivers would have tremendous incentive to lobby Congress and say, look, we've got all of these workers who are going to be out of jobs. We need some regulation in place that limits the self-driving trucks. And so we limit the self-driving trucks and these guys keep their jobs. You say, well, that's good. They kept their jobs. Yeah, except the next generation that comes along, they'll also become truck drivers because we preserve these jobs. And all that happens is we keep this problem in play generation after generation. If instead we do it the way I'm describing, we say, okay, self-driving trucks are replacing everybody. Truck driver jobs are gone. We'll cut you guys a check for the money you would have earned. Once you retire, I'm done with the problem. Nobody else has come into this industry. Everybody else is trained for other things.
And this sort of thing has not been done.
No.
When the Model T put every buggy maker out of business, nobody asked, what can we do for the buggy maker? Mm. It was just understood that, well, that's too bad and we're sorry, but you're going to have to deal with it. I think what Ant's talking about could be achieved by just escalating Social Security to a younger age for truck drivers.
For truck drivers, yeah.
The infrastructure is already in place to accomplish what you want to accomplish.
Now, it's not a perfect solution.
No.
There's all kinds of problems around the edges because the guy who's 45 years old, he could retrain. He hears this program and he was doing what? He was a janitor somewhere. He says, I'm going to become a truck driver.
That's right.
So I can get in under the wire so I get this thing. There's problems around the edges. But large scale, I think it's not a perfect solution, but it's a better solution than the alternatives.
You should be aware that almost everything we've talked about today, we have said exactly what you just said. It's not perfect. How often do you hear politicians saying that? There is never a perfect answer to a social problem. There are better and worse answers, and I think we owe it to ourselves and each other to go find the better ones. But that's going to require some work, and it's going to require a lot more work than listening to Joe Biden's three talking points this week. It just can't be that.
Or Donald Trump's before him.
That's right. It's the same animal to us either way. You have to be open to the very real possibility that cheap, easy answers don't exist.
How do you think, if at all, the national debt crisis will resolve? Do you think that we will keep running up deficits until we no longer can and have no other options? Or do you think that will start to resolve the issue now?
We've been doing this, James and I, for 10 years now. Yeah. And over the course of these 10 years, we have always said the same thing, and people shook their heads and said, no, it can't be that. And yet it's now coming to pass. The way we have always answered this question is the national debt crisis resolves itself in one of three or a combination of the three ways: inflation, default, taxes. And what we're experiencing now is the inflation. People always said to us, where's the inflation that you guys keep talking about? Well, we're feeling it now, and I think we're going to continue to feel it. My back of the envelope calculation is if the federal government continues in its trillion or multi-trillion dollar deficits, we can expect to see inflation of the 5 to 15% range for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, maybe for as long as there are dollars.
As long as there are dollars. So there's that, or a default. If you get a default, here's what it's going to look like. At no point will any politician say that they've defaulted. They will, in effect, default, and they've done this before. It happened back in the 1980s. It will come with Social Security. And they'll say something like, in fact, they're going to say it to you. They're going to say to you, as you start approaching retirement, look, I'm sorry, we just don't have the money to pay you that we promised. But look, Social Security wasn't designed for you. You all are educated people. You have employers who are contributing to retirement plans for you. You're privileged in a way that many people aren't privileged. And how did you become these privileged people with employers that contribute to retirement funds for you? Well, you did it because you got an education through the public school system, and then you went on to get college degrees, which were subsidized by the federal government. It's time for you to give back. And the way you're going to give back is by forfeiting your Social Security retirement benefits.
You have to pay your fair share.
You'll pay in, but you won't receive anything. That's an effective default. Now, the government did this back in the 1980s, although they did it differently. What they said was, prior to the 1980s, retirement benefits were tax-free. Starting in the 1980s, the Congress changed the rules and said, henceforth, you retirees, you're receiving Social Security benefits, they're now going to be taxed as income. Well, I'm sorry, but mathematically, that's identical to a 20% default on the money you promised me. So you're going to see that. You're going to see default, and you're going to see higher taxes. You're already seeing it as politicians talk about taxing unrealized capital gains. And notice what they do. They always point to the billionaires, and they say the billionaires have these capital gains. They're unrealized. What that means is I own stock. The stock price went up. My stock is now worth more. But I haven't sold it. I actually have no cash. It's like you buy a car for $7,000 and the book value on the car goes up next year to $10,000. And the politicians say, you made a $3,000 gain. You say, what do you mean I made a $3,000 gain? I don't have any $3,000. Yeah, on paper, your car is worth $3,000 more. That's an unrealized capital gain. Well, if Congress starts to tax unrealized capital gains, they're pointing to billionaires. They're actually thinking about you. Because the middle-class Americans have unrealized capital gains in the form of their homes, the value of their houses, the value of their retirement funds. If we open that door to taxing unrealized capital gains, the middle class is sitting on a wealth of unrealized capital gains that the politicians are going to go after. So that's the three responses: inflation, which we're already experiencing, a default, which you're going to see on your Social Security, and higher taxes, which if they can get it through the door on unrealized capital gains, that 18% I was talking about, the government collects 18% of the economy, that's going to jump.
I think it's going to be far, far worse than that. I'm much more pessimistic than Anthony is. I think they're going to monetize the debt. I think that will make dollars functionally worthless over time. And we'll get to the point where people are weighing money here too. I mean, look, in Venezuela, even if the government collapsed there, what do you still have? Venezuelans. They have a demographic likeness. They're the same people. Here, what do we have? Well, we're a country based on ideas. We don't have an ethnic basis. And when we get to the point where none of us care about our ideas anymore, and I think we're about there, and then the monetization of the massive debt comes in with that sucker punch immediately thereafter, I think the entire United States will collapse. I think the monetary system goes first and the political system goes next.
I don't disagree with what James said, but I do want to put a big footnote. Collapse, in my mind, doesn't mean a return to anarchy.
No, that's right.
We're shooting in the streets and that kind of thing. Rather, I think what it takes the format of is something like Brexit, where the UK says, look, thank you very much. We've had enough of this. We're going to go do our own thing. And there's some amicable separation. I think you'll see something similar amongst the states or groups of states.
Yeah, I do too.
Pennsylvania says, all right, California, look, you guys are very nice. We like you, but you're crazy people. You go do your thing. Let us do our thing.
I think there is an example out there of how this is all going to break down. If you look up the FEMA disaster relief map, what you see is that they've divided the United States up into 10 geographic regions, regions that make a lot of sense. So you see Northern California, Oregon, and Washington chunked off. You see the Desert West chunked off. The Mountain West is another. Roughly speaking, New England is another, the Eastern Seaboard. And if you ask yourself right now, you all live in Maryland, what do you share in common with me in Tucson? And the answer is almost nothing. In Tucson, where I live, we are 80 miles north of the Sonoran Desert, so we have a very heavy Mexican population, 40%. I grew up in New England. Where I live now is nothing like New England. And I kind of like the Mexican introduction. So everything is kind of cool that way. And when Ant talks about the collapse, and we talk about it together a lot, his warning is always the same. Don't think that this is the end of the world. Because what will happen, people will continue right along. And all of the productive capacity we have right now will have after this disaster strikes too. So it's literally not the end of the world. It's probably a 3 to 5 year problem.
Yeah, and James says disaster. I don't characterize it as disaster so much as transformation. I think we transform back to what the founders had in mind, which is a limited federal government and most governing being done at the state level.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Take care.
And that's all the time we've got this week on Words and Numbers. Until next time, be sure to follow us on Twitter. Handles are in the show notes. Join Words and Numbers Backstage, the Facebook group where the conversation continues, and
send us email, wordsandnumberspodcast@gmail.com.
But until next week, try to be nice to one person. One person who doesn't deserve it. Just one. And who knows, it may turn into a trend.
Well, that's an interesting twist. Be nice to one person who doesn't deserve it.
Being nice to people who deserve it is easy.
That's easy, right.
Being nice to somebody who doesn't deserve it is really hard. Give it a shot. You might feel good about yourself. Till next week, can't take it easy.
See you next week, James.